This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. A piece out last month in The Atlantic asserted that a lot of people in therapy don't need to be in therapy. There's been a movement among high-profile people, influencers, celebrities, even politicians, to promote therapy in the same way you promote exercise, something to do all the time, even if your life looks and feels pretty good. But our guest disagrees. He says therapy is not designed for that. It's the training wheels on your bike, and at some point, they've got to come off.
Ideally, the goal should be to end therapy because you've acquired this skill and knowledge, and when you stop it, you bring it with you.
Dr. Richard Freeman of Weill Cornell Medicine joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us. As always, when we talk about mental health on this show, we want to offer a quick warning. This episode will talk about mental illness, talk therapy, and being in crisis. Listener discretion is advised. If you need help, the National Crisis Lifeline is reachable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling or texting 988. You can get more information or chat online by visiting 988lifeline.org. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I've been in and out of therapy for the majority of my life. And I was in a conversation with somebody recently where they were like, well, don't you think that's a problem? Like, maybe you need a different therapist. And I was like, oh no, like this isn't, I'm not in it to be done. Like, this is a gift I give myself. This is how I have a trainer for my body. This is my mental trainer. And I want to be learning and growing. And so I want to give myself the mental and emotional support to stay in shape mentally and emotionally for myself, for my work, for my family. So I love it.
Actress Kerry Washington talked about her relationship with therapy during a recent interview. Discussing psychotherapy used to be considered taboo. But over the past 20 years, it's become common for actors, musicians, influencers, British royals, even first families, to purposely bring the issue of mental health out into the open. Our guest today isn't bothered by talking about therapy. He's concerned with the way people talk about it and possibly promote it as an ongoing treatment, like Kerry Washington comparing her therapist to a physical trainer, rather than as a tool we use occasionally to cope with the most traumatic times in our lives. According to our guest, most of us just don't need constant therapy. Our guest is Richard Freeman, a writer and professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your view is that therapy is seen as an assignment that lasts your whole life, right? That some people are seeing this as something they just continue having, somebody they check in with constantly, as opposed to an occasional appointment they might have with a dentist. Is that accurate?
Right. I think that that's true, but I think what you said probably applies just to a small segment of people who are in therapy. To be honest, you know, most people who, you know, seek out therapy go to therapy for a specific problem, anxiety, depression, a relationship issue, work problem. And then when they feel like they've solved it and met their goal, they stop. But then there's another view of therapy, which is more along the lines of what you're suggesting, where people like the idea of being in therapy the way we like to have, let's say, a physical trainer, you know, something that doesn't really have a finite set of goals and can go on indefinitely. So it was more bringing up the question about whether that's a good or a bad thing.
Okay, so there's a lot of caveats here, because as you say, most people, if they do go into therapy, if they can afford it, only go for maybe 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes a little longer if they have PTSD or another more serious mental health issue. So you're already talking about a subset of a subset.
Exactly.
Okay, so I mean, for that small group of people, do you think it's of concern that they continue to go through therapy sometimes throughout their lives?
So I think the concern I have is not that it's harmful, but that it may be an unnecessary use of resources, A, for them, and also because, you know, therapy is a scarce resource to begin with. There are not a lot of therapists. And there are many, many people who need it. And I realize, of course, you know, insurance companies, you know, are very stingy about covering psychotherapy, whether it's the short term kind of therapy or more long term. So if you occupy one of those spots, it means there are fewer people who can get it. Admittedly, we're talking about a select number of people. And of course, there are going to be people who could afford it and would come back and say, yes, I understand that, but I can afford it. So why shouldn't I continue it indefinitely? And the answer I have is, if you think therapy is something that gives you a set of, let's say, goals, self-understanding, then ideally the goal should be to end therapy because you've acquired this skill and knowledge. And, you know, when you stop it, you bring it with you. So in effect, you become your own trainer. You've learned certain skills, certain things you've learned about yourself, and you're able to take that out and generalize it and bring it out into the world and your relationships and all the things and areas in life that are important to you and see how you do on your own.
You did say, though, in your piece that there's a chance that this could cause harm. In other words, you said, and I want to quote you here, that the most commonly sought versions of psychotherapy are simply not designed for long-term use. In fact, there's reason to believe talk therapy in the absence of acute symptoms may sometimes cause harm.
Right. So let me explain that. So what I was referring to there, and there wasn't a lot of space to do it, is to suggest that in place of action and changing things in one's own life, focusing on yourself, I mean, for want of a better phrase, you know, navel-gazing, which some forms of therapy turn into, is harmful in that it delays effective action in life that would change the very thing the person is unhappy about. And, you know, we all know, I mean, there's a lot of science about this. The sort of self-focused wandering mind is an unhappy one. Sometimes the most effective thing is not thinking about yourself and your problems, but actually going out into the world and being engaged in activities and other people. So to that extent, I think it's psychologically harmful.
Okay, but the NIH, National Institutes of Health, reports that almost 60 million adults have a mental health disorder. Other studies have shown that more than half of those people do not get treatment. And those that do end up getting treatment often have a long gap between the onset of symptoms and when they actually get treatment. In fact, the studies show it's sometimes about 11 years on average.
Right. So we're talking about two different things, though. You're talking about studies the NIMH did in populations of people who have serious bona fide psychiatric illness, like major depression, anxiety disorders, et cetera. And for them, you know, half of them at the most receive any treatment at all, which is really shame of the nation.
Right. But what I'm saying is that isn't it better to err on the side of caution? In other words, as a nation, our problem is that not enough people are getting treatment. In fact, there's something that people have been calling psychology imposter syndrome, mental health imposter syndrome, where a lot of people don't go to therapy because they think, oh, this isn't that bad. Right. I'm not suicidal. I don't need therapy. I'm not having a mental health crisis. I don't need therapy. And that often prevents people from going to therapy. Don't you think there's a danger of at any time discouraging people from seeking a doctor's advice?
I would always err on the side of caution and tell people and encourage people to go in and get help. But what I'm referring to in this piece is not that population, but people who are really, you know, high functioning, moderately symptomatic, but don't have serious mental disorders. So we're talking about two separate things that are both true. One is people with really serious problems, serious mental problems in this country, which accounts for probably, you know, 45, 50% lifetime risk in the country. They often go untreated, which is a terrible thing. So of course, we need to target those people and provide them with the treatment they need. But I'm talking about a really special subsegment of the population in this piece of people who really barely have serious problems at all, who are in unending therapies and who view therapy the way some people view physical training.
So, I mean, I get that I fully understand that you're talking about not just the celebrities like Kerry Washington, but I have a close friend who's been in therapy for decades. And I wonder if this isn't actually a problem with the doctors themselves and the way they're trained. Shouldn't it be on the doctor to say, okay, you came in 10 years ago for anxiety and you seem to be doing fine? Or for a doctor to say, I've been treating you for 10 years, you're still suffering from anxiety. This isn't working. Either let's find you a different doctor or try something else. Isn't that the doctor's responsibility?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that question. You know, because what it opens onto is a larger question, which is that the physicians and the therapists themselves have an intrinsic conflict of interest. And for two reasons. One is the obvious financial one. It's, you know, you don't want to let go of an easy, charming patient. But the other is attachment. I mean, just like you know, patients get attached to their friends, they get attached to their therapist. And it's hard to say goodbye. And therapists do the same thing. They enjoy their patients. You know, they're attached to them. And so, you know, to be able to say to a patient, you know what, you came to see me, you know, 5 years ago when you were anxious and depressed, but I want you to know, at least from my perspective, things are much better. What do you think? And then have a discussion about it. And the patient says, yes, I agree with you. And you say, well, maybe we should consider taking a vacation from therapy to see how you function on your own.
So you are a professor of clinical psychiatry. Did you also do training in talk therapy?
I did.
Psychotherapy?
I did.
Because we're sometimes talking about people who have depressive symptoms that are not going to be cured. Right? These are people who, because of chemical imbalances or other often genetic conditions, will suffer from and struggle with depression or anxiety their entire lives. It's not a problem that can be solved.
Yeah.
What about them?
Right. So for those patients, as I said in the piece, people who have chronic ongoing, you know, conditions need ongoing treatment. In other words, the treatment has to match the problem. That's all. You know, if somebody is got symptoms and they're having a hard time, of course they need treatment and they should stay in treatment until they're better. And even chronic problems are intermittent. People get better. And when they get better, they leave treatment. And, you know, for a period of could be many, many years when they're fine, they are not in treatment at all. And then when they have an episode of anxiety or depression, they call their therapist back and say, hey, I'm having a hard time. I've gotten depressed again. I need to come and see you. And that's a perfectly wonderful, sensible model for treatment, which is intermittent treatment. When you need it, you go back.
We're going to take a break in just a couple minutes, but another question just before we do that, because, you know, the difficulty for me and one of the things that's making me so hesitant here, although I agree with pretty much everything that you're saying, the hesitancy I have is that there are so many populations and people who already are hesitant to go into therapy at all. And it's not that I don't think what you're saying is accurate. It's just that I fear that any message telling people to limit therapy or question whether they really need it might discourage those very people, you know, people from minority communities, immigrants. They are much less likely to seek therapy when they need it. And I just, you know, they don't always split hairs the way you and I do because we're navel gazers, right? We think about this stuff possibly too much. But that's not the way most of the population is. They might hear a message or just see your headline and read the first paragraph of your piece in The Atlantic and take that to mean, yeah, I probably shouldn't go into therapy.
Fair enough. And God help me if that's the case. Last thing in the world I want to do. I mean, I run a clinic in which we treat people who have lifelong serious illness. And those are patients who we treat for many, many, many years. And when we have them, we keep them, even if they end their treatment temporarily and come back to us. But we've known them for decades. And I'm hoping that all your listeners get the message loud and clear. If you're having a psychiatric problem or feel distressed, absolutely you should seek help with a mental health practitioner.
Okay, we're going to take a break, but there's a lot more to talk about here, no pun intended, on Talk Therapy. I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and we will return. And we're back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and today we're talking about when therapy should end. My guest today is Dr. Richard Friedman, who is at Weill Cornell Medicine. Before we took a break, we were talking about being careful with messaging, right? Making sure we don't discourage those who really should be in treatment from seeking it out, because I think that refers to a large percentage of the United States. So what do you think? I mean, I understand it's all variable. All of this varies depending on the patient and their specific needs. But at what point, 3 months, six months, at what point does somebody who did not come to the doctor with a truly serious chronic problem, at what point should they be thinking, okay, this should end?
So I think that they could ask themselves a couple of questions that would help to make it clear, which is, if you think about what brought you to treatment in the first place, what is it you wanted to change about your life? Whether it was trouble with relationships or difficulty at work or not knowing what your mission in life is, if the answer to it is, you know what, I've made a lot of progress, and I feel at this point well enough that I want to go off and see how I do on my own, then a reasonable thing is to talk to your therapist and say, here's what I think, what do you think? And then consider when it's time to stop, meaning progress isn't made towards the various goals, whether they're concrete goals or they're, you know, internal emotional goals, but that you feel like you've made enough headway that you feel ready to go off on your own. It's kind of like, you know, when you're, you know, learning to ride a bicycle and say, you know, I get the hang of it. I think I know how to do it. I think I'm ready to take training wheels off and see if I could ride the bicycle. And if not, and if it's problematic in the next couple of weeks or months, you go back.
So, you know, the thing is, I mean, having been a journalist who's read a lot of scientific studies over the course of my career, I will say the least reliable data we get is self-reporting, right? We're the worst judges and analysts when we're analyzing ourselves. That's my first reaction. The second thing I would say is that what's the harm? Let's say that somebody is using that therapist as a crutch, right? I would think that one of the worst things is that person is using the therapist as a replacement for a truly close friend, right? Instead, they're going in every week or every other week so they can talk about their lives and problems. What's so wrong with that? I mean, why not? If the therapist has time, it's making the therapist money. If it's making that person feel better, that's okay, right?
So I would say it's not harmful. It just may not be necessary. So eventually the relationship with the therapist will end. And all your eggs, if that's the case, that this is basically a paid friend, are in that one basket. And the therapist has not served you well, because what will you do when the relationship ends, either because of, you know, unforeseen circumstances, illness, death, separation, all kinds of things. And you have to then go out in the world and do what you needed to do in the first place, which is to form social networks, have relationships, have bonds, have the very thing that therapy is supposed to enable you to do. So in that sense, I would say you're missing something. Is it harmful in the present? No. And if you can afford it, by all means. But if you use the model of a trainer, I think therapy is slightly different, because the goal should be to enable you to be autonomous and independent.
So, I mean, I feel like we agree 90% of the way. And most of my hesitation is exactly what I mentioned earlier, that I don't think people read the whole article. Whatever the version of that is for podcasts, I feel like people often skim things and take away the wrong message. That's where most of my hesitation comes from. On the other hand, I'll tell you a way in which I absolutely agree with you, and that is that I often see people consulting therapists who don't demand any change from them at all. And I wonder if that's harmful, because, you know, I have known several people in my life who've been with the same therapist or been with therapists who are all relatively similar in that they went in every other week, they spent an hour talking, and there was no behavioral change recommended.
Yeah.
That would be harmful, would it not?
I mean, what would you think the harm is in that case?
Well, because they went to the doctor because they were having an issue and not coping, and they're basically continuing with an untreated mental illness, right? It's not being treated.
Right. Well, that's just bad treatment, because if the first thing you want to do if you're a therapist is help the person identify what it is they're in treatment for. Now, it could be, let's say it's just an exploratory treatment. I mean, there are treatments that are like that. They're very rare. Let's say psychoanalysis, where the goal is, let's say, to figure out like what is hidden from view, what's unconscious that's causing distress, or even to change character traits. That's a long process. It's not so easily defined by goals, but most therapy is not like that. Most therapy, someone comes in and says, the following things are bothering me. I want you to help me with them. And the therapist is supposed to say, okay, I get it. Let's learn all we can about you. And then we're going to figure out the best strategy to help with those things that bother you. So it should be clear.
So that brings me back to the fact that this is a problem with your industry.
Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, what is the solution here? I mean, I feel like if somebody wants to stay in therapy for their whole life, you know, and you can afford it,
right,
more power to you.
Right.
That's my personal feeling. But I also feel like therapists, there are all different kinds of therapists, especially talk therapists. Some of them have a counseling degree, right? Like, there's all different types. They're not all using cognitive behavioral therapy or other types that are focused on solving a specific problem or reaching a specific goal. And therefore, perhaps the entire industry needs to change the way they treat clinicians, and also accountability.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody following up on any of these therapists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a provocative point, which is, you know, you could say this about any form of treatment, whether it's psychological treatment or it's medical treatments. You know, clients and patients and doctors and therapists are often out on their own. And who is helping either one of them decide, is the treatment any good? You know, could you even think about regulating something like this? I could imagine that would be a nightmare. You know, I like to think that people at least have some degree of self-awareness. You know, I have seen so many patients over my professional life who come in and say, you know, I was in treatment, but I left because X, Y, and Z. I don't feel like it was helping. I think it was not really effective. I mean, people are actually more discerning, I think, than you might imagine, and more critical. So I'm more worried about the first thing that you said, which is we have a lot of therapists who may not be so well trained and who are not focusing, let's say, on what is best for the patient, either because, you know, they just don't know how to do it, or because they have a conflict of interest.
In conflict of interest being, as long as that patient continues to come to them, they're still getting an income.
A and B, psychological conflict of interest. I mean, they're attached to their patient and they really like them. And they would be reluctant to let them go. I mean, I've my patients are wonderful and I enjoy talking to them, and I'm often sad to see them go. But when they're well, and they've met their goals, I tell them what I think. And I say, let's talk about possibility that you may no longer need to be in treatment.
So I wonder how annoyed you are then by the the relationship between therapist and patients that's so frequently portrayed in media, in movies and TV shows, you know, where the same person will go every single week to a therapist for years and years and years and years. And look, very often they're going in to see that therapist just so the therapist can tell them that the decisions they already made were right.
Yeah.
Like, right, they're going into a therapist to settle arguments for them and say, no, you're right, that other person was out of line. That's such a stereotype.
Yes.
Is that, I assume that bugs you.
You know, it bugs me, but if it meant that there were people like this who were doing that, and that most people, when they hear this podcast, get encouraged to go to therapy because it will help them for problems that really get in their way, I'm perfectly happy that there are some people who are going to be doing exactly what you just said if it means most people will get treatment they need. So I wrote this, yes, because it happens. But really, the motivation I had for writing this piece comes from work with my residents, because I realized that doctors are really good at starting treatment, but they're often not good at trying to figure out when it served its purpose and it might be time to stop it. So it's a general principle. And I was then first thinking about, you know, medication. And I thought, well, I should apply the same principle to psychological treatment as well. When are you done? When have you had enough? When has the treatment served its purpose?
Interesting, because that sounds then that even in your piece, you're talking to your colleagues.
Very much so. And in fact, you might wonder what they thought about it.
I that was my very next question, because and I'm not going to name them because I'm not trying to start a battle here. But I have read quotes from your colleagues at Weill Cornell saying there's nothing wrong with just seeing a therapist for the rest of your life in order to become a better human.
Right. And I don't disagree with that. I think it's okay.
Wait,
and
how do you not disagree with that?
I'll tell you why. Here's the reason. Here's
it,
because
it feels like that your whole thing is that you do disagree.
No, I withheld one thing from you, which is there is a small segment of people who psychologically are unable to take the training wheels off the bike, in a sense, and go off on their own. So when they try to leave, they actually don't flourish. So for all kinds of, you know, character reasons and emotional and psychological reasons, there's a small number of people who need ongoing supportive help throughout their life.
Yeah.
They're there. But it's a really tiny fraction of the entire population. The actual fact is people are so much more resilient than we give them credit for. And here's the evidence for that. Most people who are stressed do not get sick. Most people who are traumatized do not get PTSD. It's a minority response. Humans are remarkably tough. And that's the reason I say this.
So I'm going to push back on that whole resilient thing in just a minute, but we do have to take one more break. I'm talking to Richard Friedman about when and if therapy should end. This is Hear Me Out. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley, and we're talking today about whether or not a therapist is like a dentist or like a physical trainer. But just before the break, you were talking about how human beings were remarkably resilient. And I feel like in broad strokes, that's true. But in recent years, our resilience has been declining rapidly. And in the United States, at least, our life expectancy has fallen for several years in a row. And I remember reading the study report, I think this was probably a couple years ago, and they asked the lead author, the doctor that was the lead author on the report, what was causing this decline in life expectancy, and he said despair. So we are at a particular moment, and we could have an entire other show debating what's causing it, but we are at a moment when there is a global mental health crisis, when for whatever reason, resiliency, people's ability to recover after a challenge, is low and on the decline, especially in young people between the ages of 18 to 23, and when the stakes are really high. I mean, the number of people who take their own lives has increased. It increased about 5% just in 1 year in 2021. So are we that resilient? I don't know.
So this is a wonderful question and a huge one, because let me just try to unpack some of the things that you just said. So it is true that if you look at like the COVID years, there was an uptick, a huge one, in the rate of anxiety and depression, especially in young people. Not so much in older people, and especially in subpopulations of people of color. There were sociodemographic effects. So particularly, let's say, in young Black kids, there was a huge increase in depression and in suicidal feeling, thinking, and in some ways, behavior. So I don't mean to suggest that people are insensitive to stress. It's the opposite. They respond to stress. And some of them get ill. This was an extraordinary stress, though, because what we faced was with a plague, essentially, right? So the entire population was threatened with a life-threatening disease that was mismanaged by the administration and Trump. So you had two terrifying things. You had a national plague in which, instead of being united, the country was riven with discord, no leadership, and so it seemed like chaos. If you wanted to conjure up a stress on a national level that is huge, you couldn't do any better than that. So, of course, there was an uptick in psychiatric illness. But one interesting question is, how long will it persist? Now that COVID is over, what happens to the rates of depression and anxiety in the next couple of years? And the answer is epidemiologists don't yet know. And if it tracks with any other period that's comparable to this, they will start to drop again. That's what I mean by resilience.
We don't have the data, right? Like they weren't keeping track during the Black Plague of people's mental health and the statistics. So you're right. We have no idea quickly and how well people will bounce back.
Right. But what we do know.
But I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
But what we do know. I'm skeptical that they will.
But what we do know is, if you look at natural disasters or traumas that people go through, and this has been studied for years, the rates of PTSD following trauma, like a school shooting, for example, is actually low. And let's say, even if it were 20% of the population, 2/3 of those people who get something that looks like PTSD spontaneously recover within 6 months. So we are affected, but most people bounce back. And it's not to say that we're Teflon-coated. I don't mean to say that. It's just that we think that humans are much more sensitive to stress. They're able to handle a fair amount of stress. And there was something else that you said about resilience. Oh, that resilience is dropping. And there may also be social reasons why people feel more fragile now than, let's say, they did in the past.
Okay, but those social reasons aren't necessarily going to change. I mean, I think we have this society that's set up to give us mental health issues. We have a society where the inequality gap is massive. We have a society that leads to social isolation. And there is, even before the pandemic, a loneliness epidemic. And you and I both know loneliness for a Homo sapiens is life-threatening.
Yeah.
We have a society where that is by its nature not particularly healthy. It's not a healthy environment for a human brain, for the psychology.
Yeah.
I mean, and in that field, it feels natural to me that without massive societal change, there will be people who do not have acute mental health disorders who will simply need help coping.
Yes.
Just somebody to talk to who lets them see through the gaslighting and says, you're right. This is overwhelming.
Right. But also at the same time, I think, and it may be well-intended, there's been increased social attitude about trying to help people and insulate them from stress, which is, obviously well-intended. But when you're talking about trying to protect people from ideas that might upset them, especially in university settings now, or, you know, trigger warnings and things like this. You know, it's an unintended consequence of doing this that you essentially select for people who feel more unable to deal with a difficult world. Because if you protect them from ideas that they find troubling or upsetting, they don't learn how to deal with discord and diversity without trying to censor it and protect themselves from it. And that's not a good thing.
That sounds like you're saying we are, especially among young people, making them more vulnerable by protecting them from damaging name calling or damaging ideas. I mean, that's a careful line to walk between finally, as a society, giving voice to the people who have been abused verbally or sometimes physically, and allowing our language to change to protect those who have never been protected in the past. That's a difficult line.
Well, I think you can do them simultaneously. No, you can draw a line and say certain things, you know, certain lines you may not cross. You can't harass people. You know, you can't single them out. You can't create an environment in which people really are unsafe. On the other hand, do you also want to say you can't say things that will upset people? I don't think so. Because if that's the case, then when they leave this enclosed environment and go out in the world, they essentially don't have the psychological skills to negotiate the world, which is full of, you know, unexpected, you know, negative things. There's no light in the street that says, hey, in 400 yards, there's a dangerous idea. Take a right-hand turn. It doesn't exist.
So, I mean, this is a little bit off the tangent of the idea you brought to us. And frankly, we could have an entire other episode just on whether or not we are raising a generation of hothouse orchids, right? But to get back to the idea,
yes,
of
fair enough.
That therapy should be, I'm as much, you and I both have gone off on this tangent. It's nobody's fault. But as we close here, to get this back to this idea that therapy for most people should not last forever. I mean, the question for me is, if you can't necessarily rely on your doctor to tell you that you're not one of the people that needs constant therapy, right? Because you say they're incentivized to keep it going. And there's no accountability. There's nobody checking in other than whether or not your insurance covers it.
Right.
And again, self-reporting is one of the least accurate ways to judge the health of a Homo sapiens.
Right. What should we do?
So, yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you. So we left one thing out. You know, you have, most people have some friends and definitely a family and people with whom they're close. So I would say, and I always talk to colleagues about this, you know, I just tell patients, you know what, why don't you tell me what your really close friends, those people who really know how you think and feel, what they think about you, how you're doing. Ask them. You know, you've known me for years. You've known me for years.
Because people love feedback, right? People love performance reviews. Yeah. That's what everyone loves.
Exactly. Right. Ask me. Tell me, how am I doing? Am I better? You can ask them.
Yeah, I won't hold. I mean, look, I'm a journalist. I'm by tradition and profession cynical. I feel like most people aren't going to want to hear that. But it's a good thought.
Well, you know, you have to have some form of external data to confirm your own view. Otherwise, you know, you're off on your own and you have to make the decision by yourself. But most people do have the luxury of asking friends and family. And I always ask them, who in your life knows how you really think and feel? And they'll say, okay, it's this person or that person. I said, oh, for God's sake, then ask them. I want to know.
Huh. So I'm willing to bet you have an opinion about this. Maybe you yourself have been in long-term therapy. Maybe you have been seeing a therapist for a short period of time, maybe years. have you ever gone to see a therapist even though you were feeling pretty okay? And how did it help you or not? There's some evidence that about 5% of people say they're worse off when they go to talk therapy. Maybe you're one of them. If so, we want to hear from you. Email us at hearmeout@slate.com. Now, a couple weeks ago, we had Maxwell Stearns on the show. He argued that we should not, as American citizens, directly elect the president. The House of Representatives should, in a parliamentary system. We got a bunch of great thoughts from you about that idea. So before we go, we want to share some thoughts from a listener named David. David wrote this: "Excuse me for saying so, but the ideas expressed to, quote, fix the American system are too way out there. Further, there's no way to predict that the outcome would be what the guest suggests. Yes, our system needs fixing. But I believe there are more realistic and practical approaches that can be taken. For instance, multi-choice voting, adopting national voting standards, banning partisan gerrymandering, banning dark money campaign spending, just to name a few. These actions can be implemented piecemeal and the results monitored so that adjustments can be made as needed." David, thank you. You are speaking my language. Experimentation, evidence-based reform. I'm all about that, David. Thank you for that comment. And all the rest of you, thank you for sending in your thoughts and ideas. We really do read them all, and we want to hear them. Our email address, again, is hearmeout@slate.com. We know you have thoughts to share. Keep them coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.